So I want to discuss happiness. Thank you. I want to discuss happiness today and move into the loving kindness practice as well as part of our exploration. And I thought it would be interesting, actually, if you just take a few moments, each of you, and think what associations you have with the word happiness, first of all. And then think what would be a time in your life that is connected to that concept of happiness. When were you happy? Maybe it was this morning, maybe it was last night, maybe some time a long time ago pops up. It's kind of interesting, isn't it? And I hope to hear from you a little later in terms of what might have come up for you. There have been many times when I've taught loving kindness meditation, which classically begins with a phrase, may I be happy, or may you be happy, and had people feel, you know, a little disparaging of that. Well, like happy people are stupid people, or happy people aren't connected to what's going on. They're not really aware of what's happening in the world. If you were really aware of what's happening in the world, how could you possibly be happy? You know, it's like miserable time and so on. And so it's just interesting to see, first of all, what associations come up. Does happiness imply being a little dull-witted or disconnected from how things are? Does it imply something else? And what was that time when you would use the word happiness to describe your experience? Was it a time of innocence? Was it a time of having? Was it a time of just being independent of what was going on around you? Was it a time of being praised by a lot of people? Was it a time of being ignored and left alone in a nice sort of way? You know, it's quite a fascinating exploration. I can remember some years ago when the Dalai Lama came to New York City. The first time in the last few years that he's come. He gave several days of teachings at a theater, a rented theater, and then a huge public talk in Central Park. And a friend of mine had arranged, she was organizing everything, including the public talk, and I knew that her great desire was that the talk, which was, you know, completely free, no registration, just open, would attract really quite a large number of people. And the day before the talk, it had rained and rained and rained, and we thought, uh-oh. But the morning of the talk, it wasn't raining. And I got up and walked over to Central Park, and I couldn't see anything, but I could hear the sound of Tibetan monks chanting in the distance. So I just entered the park and followed the sound. And then I turned a corner into the meadow, and there was like a sea of people. Like everywhere the eye could land, there were people. There was just an enormous number of people. The unofficial estimates for the day were about 250,000 people, and that's what it looked like. It was just enormous. And we sat down, and I felt like we sat together in an unusual kind of quiet, given how many people were there. And then when the Dalai Lama began speaking, he actually said something quite striking to me. He said, you know, from a certain point of view, I haven't had such an easy life. He said, I had to assume temporal power when I was 16. I had to flee into exile in my early 20s. I've had to try to keep culture in exile intact for all of these years. I've had to hear and feel for the terrible conditions often prevailing inside Tibet for so many years. And he said, it hasn't been such an easy life. And then he said, but I'm pretty happy. You know, and just like that, I'm pretty happy. And of course, that's what one sees in him. You know, he doesn't seem morose and, you know, horribly upset all of the time, you know, anxious, driven by it. He said, I'm pretty happy. Now, clearly, this isn't the same kind of happiness as, you know, being first online to get into the Harry Potter theater, you know, which I happened to be last night. But that is because I was paying attention. They made an announcement, and everyone else was just in the lobby talking to one another. I just got online. Anyway, it's not that kind of happiness. You know, and it's not the kind of happiness of being completely unaware and disconnected, kind of living in a little bubble, you know, and refusing to look at the pain and the suffering and the discord and the fear that exists. It's not that kind of happiness either, naturally. It's something very, very different. I'm pretty happy. And he went on to say, the reason that I'm pretty happy, even though it hasn't been such an easy life, is because of the force of compassion. He said, compassion makes me feel at one with everyone. Another time, he said something he's quite famous for when he said, I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. I've never met anyone I consider a stranger. So imagine walking into a room and meeting somebody and how we might normally be just through the force of habit. And what it would be like not to be so defensive and self-preoccupied and wondering, you know, like, what do they think of me? Do they like me? How much do they like me? Oh, no, I said that thing. It was really stupid. I shouldn't have said that. They don't like me, you know. And it's just like, what if none of that were there? And there was just like this sense of presence and caring. It would be pretty happy, actually. So he said, I am pretty happy because of the force of compassion. Compassion makes me feel at one with everyone. So if you imagine our day and take away the defensiveness and the ego-driven activity and the fear and the tension, the sense of estrangement, the sense of disconnection, he's pretty happy. It was really quite amazing sitting in that crowd hearing him make that statement, because I bet, let's say there were 250,000 of us sitting there, I bet quite a number of us could have said it hasn't been such an easy life, and perhaps not hardly anybody would have then said, but I'm pretty happy. And so that is really a very powerful exploration. A lot of times it's not such an easy life, if not in a steady, unremitting kind of way, certainly intermittently. And yet, what is happiness that is not going to shatter? Is there a happiness that's not going to shatter as we go down and then up and then down and then up and then sort of in between for a while and then down and then up? So the Buddha described life, the nature of life, I talked about this a little bit yesterday, as having eight vicissitudes. He said this is actually the fabric of life. It's pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute. Pleasure and pain, gain and loss, praise and blame, fame and disrepute. We go up and we go down. It's just in the nature of things. Once I was hiking with some friends in this park in Northern California, and we had decided we were going to hike in for several days, like 3 days, and then on the fourth day we were going to turn around and retrace our steps and come back out on the very same trail. So this was the third day, and we're still going in. And it turned out to be a day of very many hours of quite steady downhill walking. And the person I was walking with, it's like he and I were sort of struck by simultaneous realization. And he turned to me and he said, in a dualistic universe, downhill can only mean one thing. And sure enough, the next day when we turned around to retrace our steps, it was many, many hours of uphill walking. And it's not to say that on every level it's a dualistic universe, but on the level in which we experience pleasure and pain and gain and loss and praise and blame and fame and disrepute, it is. Because that's just the kind of, it's the nature of the conditions that present themselves. If you're going to walk in on a trail and it's downhill and you're walking out on the same trail, it's going to be uphill. It's just in the nature of things. And so our deepest sense of happiness probably can't be contained in those conditions because they always change. They change, and we know this. I mean, we all know this, I'm sure, that life can change on a dime. It's just like, shh, there it is. One phone call, and it's a different life. It's amazing. There's nothing stable. There's nothing secure in that way. So we look for a kind of happiness, maybe with great confidence, maybe with not so much confidence, but nonetheless we look to see what isn't going to be dependent so much on these circumstances. And that's also not to say that we don't try to create good or pleasant circumstances. I mean, of course we do. One question might be, how much do we try? How dependent are we? I mean, we're sitting in this lovely room. It's wonderful. You know, it's really it's a privilege and a joy. It's a source of great joy to be able to be in this great place. I'm really happy it's cooler, you know. You know, that's the reality of things. If it were not, we would try to get in more fans, you know. And so it's not sort of this self-punishing attitude of I must always be miserable in order to be pure. But what are we dependent on? What are we counting on? What can we rely on? What's a real refuge for us? What do we look to when the fan doesn't work? When your car doesn't work, when your body doesn't work, when relationships get strange, when we, you know, go to the movies and it's all sold out. What do? Where do we turn? You know, certainly from the Buddhist point of view, there's a vision of happiness and a potential for happiness that is not bound up in those conditions. So it's much more reliable. So what is it? You know, where does it come from? We all have experienced it in various forms and various ways. And then, of course, the genius of a teacher like the Buddha is that he describes a path. I think we all have experienced, for one thing, the kind of the power of our own minds. You know, we could be, well, like I was in Maui, you know, the most beautiful place imaginable. And we could be frightened, or we could be depressed, or we could feel lonely. Or we could be angry. We're not so happy. Or we could be in a very trying, difficult circumstance, but we're filled with faith, or we're in love, or we feel tremendously supported by others and their care. And it doesn't make the circumstance disappear. It's still very difficult. It's a maybe very large challenge, but it's different than were we to be in that very same circumstance and feel completely alone and bereft of faith and so on. So we look within for some of the aspects of a very powerful kind of happiness. It's not only within, but it's, in a way, its source is within, because that's what allows us to maybe reach out to others or allow others to reach out to us or engage in service or something that will help actually manifest some sense of more connection. But we look within for the root, for the source, for the beginning of it, because it's very powerful. Our minds are very powerful. You know, I think it's it would be very reckless and not so smart to completely disregard external circumstance, to say that, you know, we should all be just fine, even though, you know, the building is on fire, or, you know, we haven't been able to feed our children or something. You know, it's not like that. But we look within for the kind of strength that doesn't negate completely the power of external circumstance, but allows us, to the best of our ability, to use the kind of resourcefulness and resiliency that we do have in those circumstances, to not be completely defined by our circumstance, and so on. So it's the Dalai Lama. It hasn't been such an easy life, but I'm pretty happy. In a way, the Buddha exemplifies this when he talks about the middle way, which was the guiding force of his path, not falling into reliance or dependence on sense pleasure for our deepest kind of happiness, not assuming that punishing ourselves or mortifying ourselves is the way, but finding a path that is connected to our inner strengths, to our connection to the world, that's based on wisdom, awareness, love, and compassion. That's really the path. So they say that when the Buddha taught lay people who were not ordained as monks or nuns, he always began with speaking about generosity as a factor of mind and as a practice. So the reason for that was to help people get in touch with a source of great happiness. And that's the beginning, which is kind of funny, you know, for a path that's so associated with suffering. You've got to face your suffering, you've got to look at it, you've got to get through it, there's no way around it. But he starts with creating a foundation of some joy, resiliency, openness, spaciousness in our hearts. Isn't that interesting? That's the beginning. And they say he starts with generosity because everybody has something to give. If you don't have enough or a lot materially, you can give of your energy. You can pay attention to somebody. You could smile at someone. You know, it doesn't have to be like a lavish material offering, but just that sense. You know, you can allow someone ahead of you online. You know, you can share. You know, it's like that very famous quotation from the Buddha when he said, If you knew what I did about the power of giving, you wouldn't let a single meal go by without sharing something. So that also includes like a grain of rice to an aunt, you know. Everybody has something to give. And it brings a lot of joy. Because the opposite of that, the kind of clinging, craving, holding on, wanting to possess, not wanting anything to change, not wanting to share, is such a shut down state. You know, it's often driven by fear. And the giving is so kind of open. And it's like an adventure a little bit too, which I'll describe in a minute, you know. And it brings us back in touch with a sense of inner abundance. Because the best kind of generosity, because motivation is considered so important in the teachings, the best kind of generosity isn't, of course, it's not forced and it's not mannered and it's not to show off, but it's coming from a sense of having enough. And so it's almost like this natural gesture that we want to offer. And we know that too, just from life, that we might know people who, in terms of material generosity, don't have very much, but they have some feeling, and so they give. They have some inner feeling about giving. And then we might know people who have a huge amount more, but they don't even have that inner sense of having enough, and so they can't open or share. You know, it's just that kind of closed down state. Or in our own experience, when we maybe have an impulse to give something, and this means a reasonable thing, not, I don't know what's a good example for here. In New York City, I say not giving away your rent-controlled apartment, you know, ever, ever, ever. You know, so it's reasonable, let's say, in this example. It's not going to harm anyone, you know, in like your family or something if you give it away. And you have a pretty strong impulse to give that object away. And then the next 50 thoughts are fearful. Oh, no, no, what if I need it? You know, I haven't worn it in 10 years. But, you know, maybe tomorrow I'll wear it. I better not give it away. I can't even find it, but I shouldn't give it away, you know, because... Or, like in my case, I will read those books. I know it, you know. They're piled up, you know, in two places now. But I can't give them away because I know I'm going to read them someday. I'm not going to work ever for like 6 months. I'm just going to read. I know it, you know. So I better not give it away. You know, I mean, those thoughts, those second thoughts or third thoughts or fifth thoughts, you know, are very fearful. I don't have enough. I'm going to need it. I don't know what my life will be like. I can't sacrifice it. You know, and it's quite interesting to compare those two moments, the moment of wanting to give and then the moment of like, oh, no. And one kind of practice that many people amongst my friends have undertaken is when that impulse to give is quite strong and reasonable, to actually give that object, even though the next 50 thoughts are fearful, just to see, you know, and keep paying attention to how everything feels. There's a kind of joy in the giving that is very precious. And again, it doesn't, you know, it doesn't have to, and it shouldn't harm you or, you know, those you're responsible for in any way. But you can notice how in touch, more in touch you might feel with that sense of enough and sharing and not being so alone and so on in the giving. So when I was saying it was an adventure, I was thinking of, there's this teaching in Buddhism which I always found a little odd. And that was, if you're angry at somebody, give them a gift. I thought, isn't that weird? It's kind of strange. You know, because there's so much emphasis on motivation and acting, you know, from a kind of genuine and authentic way. And And so on. I thought, that's so strange, you know, like, but it's kind of interesting in the practice of it. And I've seen it both with myself and with others. Like, I witnessed once somebody who was sort of annoyed or irritated by this other person give them a gift. And the person receiving the gift, like, broke out in this really beautiful, like, childlike smile. You know, like, wow, you know, I got a gift. And that was a side of them that had not been seen in a good long time, you know, and certainly not by the person they were irritating so consistently. And it was this extraordinary moment, you know, that wasn't grounded in the dispute and the competition and the kind of nastiness that had been going on between them. It was just this pure moment of like, wow, someone gave me a gift. And I wonder if that's part of why the Buddha said that kind of unusual thing. You know, can we break down the rigidity of our roles and, you know, you're the one I don't like. And it's just a question, you know, about the adventuresome of giving. And then there is certainly, you know, a tremendous emphasis on non-material giving. There's loving kindness, which I'll talk about later. There's a very distinct kind of generosity in sympathetic joy, which is the practice and the state of when we witness someone's happiness or good fortune, instead of spiraling into tremendous jealousy and envy and feeling, ew, you know, I wish that hadn't happened for you. It's much more kind of generous feeling, and also recognizing that we get joy, we get fulfillment from rejoicing in someone else's happiness. You know, it's not a state of losing anything. So the Buddha, they say, began with talking about generosity, to be happy. You know, we walk around all the time thinking, what else do I need in order to be happy? What don't I have? And of what I have, how can I protect it from all change and competition, and not a very happy state. And so we practice. To practice generosity is almost like practicing happiness. And we keep paying attention just to see. I had a teacher once, a Tibetan teacher, who said, if you find you can't be very generous, and again, you know, it could be a grain of rice, you know, it's not the thing that's important, it's the heart space. He said, if you can't be generous, take an object, maybe an orange, in your right hand and put it in your left. And then feel it for a moment in your left hand, put it in your right. Just kind of practice a little letting go and relinquishment. And one of the things about the nature of a practice, sometimes I teach with people who don't like the word practice, you know. I don't know why, but I like the word practice, you know, because it's a very forgiving word, you know, in the sense that we're not going to be either realistic or truthful or kind if we have undue expectations about our perfection. It's better to think of all of these things as practice. And then it's also, we can allow ourselves to begin again when we've forgotten or we've acted in a way that we don't feel is really consistent with our deepest values. And we can have a certain sense of creativity or adventure. It's like, okay, I'm in the generosity journey, you know, let's see what happens. I'm like, oh no, I didn't give away that book. Well, you know, we'll see what tomorrow brings. It's okay. You know, and what held me back and all of that. So it's more like a sense of a journey and an exploration than anything. So then the concomitant practice, after generosity, they say that the Buddha talked about morality or ethics. And I'll talk a little bit about that, and then we'll maybe walk and sit and so on, and then really explore loving kindness, which is the next step after that this afternoon. So they say he began with generosity and went on to speak about morality. And this too is very much in the same spirit. If you tell a lot of lies at work, for example, and then you sit down on Sunday to do a retreat, you're going to be haunted at some point or another by what you did on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday. Maybe not this Sunday, but maybe next Sunday, or soon enough, it all will come back, because our lives are of one piece. The spiritual aspect is not cut off. It's not isolated. It's not this little activity that we do. It's all about how we live, how we are. And so what we do in a formal practice of meditation affects how we live. What we do when we live affects our experience when we sit. So the Buddha is saying, build a foundation. Create a platform where you will have the most serenity, the most tranquility, the most upliftment, the most self-respect, the most kind of openness and resiliency and buoyancy in your mind. It's not like you have to, but you're going to suffer a lot less. You know, we can set the stage or we can just not. And if we don't, there's going to be certainly a lot of tension and guilt and remorse, and all kinds of states are going to happen. So, in effect, the Buddha said, why not set the stage? For when happiness, in a sense, is, you know, a lot about openness. You know, when you're sitting and you're preoccupied, like, well, I told that lie, it was 2 weeks ago, and surely by now, if they were going to find out, they would have found out. But what if they do find out? And, you know, and I also told that other person that kind of quasi-lie, because that was a good bolstering for that original lie, and maybe I have to tell them a deeper lie that was kind of a half lie. Maybe a three quarters lie would be better, you know. But oh no, you know, like, can't go lying to everybody, you know. Then, you know, what's the nature of my friendships? I feel so alone. I don't have any friends really because I lie all the time, you know. And it's just like, it's a lot to kind of encounter every time you look within. And it's so kind of cruel to ourselves in a way. To live in a way that's careless as we are trying to really ground in greater truth and love and compassion. It's like that beautiful statement of the Buddha's where he said, if you truly loved yourself, you'd never harm another. Because first of all, we are capable of so much more and so much more happiness. And it's talk about poignancy, you know. Another thing he said was that all beings want to be happy. Everybody wants to be happy. And for the most part, people do not know how. They just don't have a clue as to how to really be happy. But that urge toward happiness in a genuine way, in an enduring way, is there within everybody. And it's so often twisted and distorted by the force of ignorance. But that urge in itself is so wondrous. And that's very poignant. We want to be happy, so we do this or we do that. And it's only looking back with much greater awareness that we might say, oh, wasn't that a miserable choice? You know, I did that to want to be happy, but then it sent me in that spiral of self-recrimination and fear of being found out and, you know, all of these other things that might happen. So for oneself, you know, out of great compassion for oneself, we look at our lives and say, okay, how am I living? You know, what is the nature of that relationship or that activity or that whatever? And these things I find are very complicated. You know, they're not that easy. They're very challenging, but they're very important. And that the very nature of that challenge is quite enlivening. You know, somebody was reminding me the other day, the classic Buddhist precepts for lay people are not killing, not stealing, not committing sexual misconduct, which means not using our sexual energy in a way that's harmful to ourselves or others, not speaking lies, and not taking intoxicants that cloud the mind or cause heedlessness. And, you know, one could explore for a lifetime any one of these, you know, and really try to understand what it means. But this person was reminding me of that last precept and a story I often tell, which is the last precept, not to take intoxicants which cloud the mind or cause heedlessness. And so that's been a subject of great debate probably forever, but, you know, I would say certainly for the last 40 years, you know. You know, people will say, well, you know, that means no alcohol, no recreational drugs at all. Other people will say, well, one beer, you know, it's like, I'm not that heedless, you know, it's just like, you know, it's just a little way to relax, you know, it's not, you know, surely that precept would refer to some kind of excessive drinking and not to one beer. And, you know, people go back and forth and back and forth and back and forth, and there are lots and lots of different interpretations of that. So one time I was in Burma, and I was practicing with Sayadaw Upandita, and somebody asked them a question, and something you learn very quickly in many walks of life is, if you're not willing to hear the answer, don't ask the question. So this guy asked him, and I could tell, you know, from the kind of hopefulness in his voice, you know, what he wanted. And he asked him this question, like, couldn't you say that, you know, one beer is like no problem and it's not really breaking the precept? And I was sitting there thinking, oh yeah, bad idea. You know, like, if you want your beer, like, forget it. And sure enough, Upandita said, there is one way in which you can have any drink at all and it not be breaking the precept, and that is if somebody ties you down hand and foot and they pour it down your throat and you don't enjoy it. He said, then it's okay. And I was sitting there, and I even then hardly ever had anything to drink, you know, alcoholic, and so it wasn't that, I didn't consider it that relevant a question to me, you know. I was sitting there thinking, oh, that's so extreme, you know. I mean, pours it down your throat, you know, like. And then I thought, oh, wouldn't it be interesting as kind of just like this extra effort to undertake a period where I did not drink at all. I mean, I didn't think it was a problem. I didn't think It was something that, you know, I was compelled to try because I was an edge or anything. I just thought, why am I so dismissive? You know, wouldn't it be more interesting to actually undertake it? And I realized how rarely we engage in kind of an adventure of virtue or morality. We think of an adventure as the other side, you know? Like, I'm going to drink all week, or, you know, like, whatever it is. And we think, oh, that's really free and wild, you know? And we don't really associate courage and, I mean, if one has the background, one might well associate courage, but just that sense of adventure. You know, like, I know, I'm going to undertake an extra precept, or I'm going to go out on the edge of morality in the positive way, you know, my edge in a positive way. I'm going to renounce some more, or I'm going to, you know, it's not that common anymore for us. And it's quite interesting just to do that. So I said, okay, you know, for 6 months, unless someone ties me down and pours it down my throat, I'm not going to drink anything. And it was really powerful. It was surprisingly powerful to me because I thought I hardly ever had anything to drink anyway, you know. But it actually made a difference, and it was quite interesting to do it in that way. And so it was, you know, not moralistic. I didn't feel horrified if I watched someone drink a glass of wine. I didn't feel separate from others. But it was like saying, okay, this is what I'm engaged in. I have, you know, many people have told me, or the first they've asked me, you know, I don't know what to do about speech. It's like I have these really good friends, and they just enjoy really maligning other people. And I used to enjoy it too, you know, and now I sit there and I feel uncomfortable as these people are trashed, you know, and I don't want to seem, you know, weird and self-righteous, and you know, what do I say? And usually what they end up saying is something like, I am undertaking an effort not to, you know, speak badly about others. I'm really interested in what happens. I've seen what happens when I do. I'm trying to see what happens when I don't. I need your help. You know, this is something I am really wanting to do in a different way in my life. It's just things like that. And I think it's really a tremendous thing to say, I am going to stretch in that direction instead of defining, you know, being a kind of free thinker in the other direction. It's like I have a friend who really prides herself on thinking of herself as like different and marching to the beat of her own drummer and, you know, being out there and kind of outrageous and things like that. And she sat a retreat I was teaching a couple of years ago in Barry, and she came up to me at the end. She said, I got it. You know, she said, if you really want to be outrageous, be kind. And I thought, wow, she did get it. You know, why not define like audacity in morality and kindness in caring and compassion? And that's happiness. That's a very great state of happiness. That's different. So the Buddha talked about a path beginning with generosity, evolving into morality, which is also a kind of generosity, called it the gift of fearlessness. Because we're giving a gift of fearlessness to ourselves. We're not sitting there all paranoid, like, oh no, what if they find out? You know, it's just like, there's that, and I just, you know, I did that, that's so terrible. And it's a gift of fearlessness to others because there's more of that sense of being a refuge for others. You know, they don't have to think we're conniving and we're trying to do this and we're trying to do that all the time. And it makes a difference. It actually does. And it is a process of coming to greater and greater serenity through that, which becomes the, and also having more and more energy because of that. So between the energy and the tranquility that come from kind of living in a more direct way, a simpler, cleaner way, both of those become the springboard for us having a great strength and being able to explore everything that comes up. You know, if you're kind of fractured anyway, and you're trying to go deeper into your mind and some very difficult thing comes up, it's not that easy. Whereas if you're not like haunted by guilt and overcome by worry, and you have a certain kind of serenity and something very difficult comes up, it's just much easier to be with it in a different way, to forge a different relationship to that state. Or if you're witnessing the suffering of someone else, it's not that easy. And the greater sense of inner abundance and composure and strength that we have, the more we can bring to that situation, instead of so quickly feeling we're overcome. We have to turn away. We have to shut down. And so we really work with establishing that platform, because it is in itself very great happiness, and it's a source of much greater happiness. So that's the beginning. And then we should really do some practice now. And then I'll go on, certainly by this afternoon, because the next stage is loving kindness and all of its different forms. So why don't we do some walking, which will get us moving, and perhaps out of this room, and we'll come back in half an hour, okay?